Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment. This is Variety Deputy Music Editor Jem Aswad, and this week's installment is a conversation with a name that people in the music industry have been hearing for more than 30 years, Kevin Lyles. He was a top executive at Def Jam Records and Warner Music. He managed Mariah Carey, D'Angelo, and Trey Songz, and he was even a recording artist who had one of his songs covered by Milli Vanilli, of all people, on their multi-platinum 1990 debut album. But he got his biggest look in January when the company he co-founded, 300 Entertainment, was acquired by Warner Music Group for a reported $400 million. That company, which releases music by such hip-hop and R&B stars as Megan Thee Stallion, Young Thug, and Gunna, is now part of Warner Music Group, and so is Lyles, who not only remains CEO of 300, but he's also CEO of Elektra Music Group, a freestanding label within Warner. And as if the deal weren't a big enough flex, just days after it was announced, one of 300's artists, Gunna, beat out The Weeknd in a photo finish for the number one spot on the Billboard Albums chart. That's a huge look for a company that, until a few days earlier, was independent. Sweetening the deal even more, Mary J. Blige, who signed with 300 last year, not only is releasing a new album on Friday called Good Morning Gorgeous, she's appearing with Dr. Dre, Eminem, Kendrick Lamar, and Snoop Dogg at the Super Bowl halftime show, which is the biggest stage and the biggest audience in the entire world for a musician. So how did Kevin Lyles get here? Good old-fashioned hustle, really. Originally from Baltimore, he attended Morgan State University on an engineering scholarship from NASA. Yes, NASA. And at the same time was working as an artist with the DJ group Newmark and interning at Def Jam. As he says in the podcast, the experience of having his song covered by a multi-platinum artist, even a controversial one like Milli Vanilli, made him realize the potential of the music business, and so did Def Jam, which at the time was part of a mini empire, including Rush Management, which handled Run-DMC, LL Cool J, and others, as well as the Fat Farm clothing line. So, he focused on Def Jam, and over the course of the 90s, rose from intern to president of the label. And while he was there, he made some of the strongest connections of his career, with 300 co-founder Lior Cohen, with artists like LL and Mary J., and maybe most notably, with Julie Greenwald, who is now co-chairman of Atlantic Records and is now again his colleague at Warner Music. Kevin Lyles has come a long way, but as we'll hear in the next 20 minutes or so, he feels like he's just getting started. So without further ado, after the break, you'll be hearing from him and me on Strictly Business.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand, when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
And we're back with Strictly Business. I am going to start off talking about the big news, which is, you know, the big 300 Warner deal, you know, reportedly $400 million deal that sees 300 and you becoming a part of Warner Music again. Big picture, what does this mean for 300? What does this mean for Warner? What does it mean for you? As much as you can say, because I know it's early.
Yeah, no, you know, the good thing about it, man, you have to think about the process. So first, you talk about Warner was, and Atlantic was our distributor. Even though we were independent, we were getting distributed through them because we helped build the company back when we went over in 04. Really, for 300, it's really no different other than now, instead of family business, it's bigger family business. It's more resources, it's more opportunity, it's more people. Instead of having 75 people, 80 people, it's now 5,000 people around the world, understanding our mission to be independent, but not alone. Our mission to be independent and have freedom, but have be capitalized to do anything that we want to do globally. And then I think for Warner, it's welcoming a prodigal son back home. It's welcoming a reunion of Julie and I, who we grew up fully our whole lives. It's given me the opportunity to work with probably 85% of the people who I knew from when I left. And most importantly, I think for them, it's they now have one of the most culturally relevant internet-born, streaming-born labels under their wing. And I plan, in their words, they want me to infect the Warner Music Group with our independent mindset virus. And actually do partner with them around the world and do great things. So I think it's a win-win for everybody. I told my staff that I've taught you guys everything about independence, taught you how to rob people to pay Paul, to brush your teeth one time a day and not use a lot of toothpaste because we don't have enough. I taught them, we might not have all the snacks in the world, but we have some good snacks. So I taught them everything about independence. Now I want to teach them about being entrepreneurs.
300 isn't changing that much, but you are now chairman CEO of Elektra, which is, look at that smile, which is a bit, you know, which is basically a freestanding major label. So are you going to run, you're running two separate businesses essentially, right?
Well, it's one business with two separate brands.
Okay.
One business, you know, 300 have its brand, and I'll make some more announcements about leadership there. And then Elektra, Mike Easterlin and Greg Nadal, people I've worked with before. Mike, we have a 25-year relationship. He was with me at Island Def Jam with. And then a bunch of the people there were at Atlantic and former Warner employees that I worked with before. So where some people feel like it's a new thing, I just feel like it's just a family reunion. And we're going to define by genres of music, define by personnel, how we're going to go out and provide the best independent mindset service amongst Elektra and its labels and amongst 300 and its labels.
It still feels like it's a good time to ask, because this is a strictly business podcast, if you have any advice about multitasking.
But Jim, you know, what COVID has told us to do is to, You in order to get through this, you have to multitask. And I really realized it even more because I got to spend more time with my family. I got to see, do more PTA meetings, more homework, Zooms, more opportunity. And so I became a better multitasker at home. But when you talk about being ambidextrous in an industry that's evolving every day, you're either going to evolve or you're going to die or you become extinct. And one of the things that I've been provided my whole life from Def Jam to Warner and now is that flexibility and opportunity to evolve. So I would say, don't put yourself in a situation that you feel that your toolbox is full of tools. You know, at 53, I still want to learn, I want to listen, I want to lead, and I want to do good in the world. And these are, and I start with listen and learn, because if, as soon as I say I don't need to know nothing, I have to step down, because I'm learning every day.
It would seem that managing as many artists as you did, as many demanding artists as you did at one time, that would have helped with the multitasking a lot, because there could be things popping with three or four of them all at once, right? How did you manage that? Did you just like sort of knock them down in order of level of crisis?
You know, Jim, when you think about it, let's go back to Def Jam. At Def Jam, I had Rockefeller, Murder, Inc., Rough Riders, Def Jam South, Fat Farm, Baby Fat, Def Comedy Jam, Def. I mean, you got a list of things. So multitasking is in my DNA. Multitasking and prioritizing is in my DNA.
Just days after the Warner deal is announced, Gunna not only has a number one album, he beat out The Weeknd, okay? No diss to The Weeknd, because it was a very close match, very close.
We love the weekend.
Whatever.
We love the weekend.
Yes. But that's huge, especially for a company that was until just days before independent. And, you know, did you guys do anything special to set up this record? Because it was really a very even race. Am I remembering right that they were both albums were announced that week and then they were just off?
Yep. I think one of the things you have to remember, we dropped Gunna single in September. One of the things you have to remember, we were thinking that we would have all the content and all the pieces in play by a certain time. We were thinking that we call audibles throughout the movement, and we were thinking that, hey, we'll drop a December album. And then we didn't have everything that we wanted, and we said, well, let's push it to next year, but let's come in late February, March. And then, you know, Gunna and I spoke, and Ebony, a wonderful management team that we had, and said, hey, why don't we start the new year off right? why don't we show people who we are, what we are, and why we are? And we didn't know who else would be on that date or anything like this. We just felt like what a way to start off the new year. And I spoke to Gunna and I said, yo, this means, because everybody's going on holiday. We made this decision when everybody was done in December. You know what I mean? So there's nobody to talk to at DSPs. There's nobody to talk to at radio. There's nobody to talk to. So, you know, for us, the staff worked diligently through it. The Warner Music Group, again, made sure that we could do what we wanted to do, and everybody was set. But this couldn't have been done without Gunna and his flexibility and opportunity to call audible and make it happen. So I tell people, I never thought, it wasn't about kicking off the year to me. It was about what's the best time to have his album come to his fans. And fortunately for us, it was January the 6th, 7th, and it happened, and the rest is history.
Want to shift gears and talk about your career and your background and going all the way back. Born in Baltimore, you went to Morgan State on a NASA scholarship? I don't think I knew that.
A lot of people don't know. You know, I joke around. When I got out of high school, I was so afraid of life because it was the first time that I said, oh, I get to make my own schedule. It wasn't gym at 9 o'clock or science at this day. You had to make your own schedule. And so I didn't know what that meant. And I also didn't know what was the necessity of other than, quote unquote, people raising kids to actually be employees. But I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I wanted to figure out what was the best way. And I remember my guidance counselor said, Kevin, what do you want to do? I said, I want to make a lot of money. I want to go change the world. I said, you can't do that by being normal. You know what I mean? I said, well, what's the biggest opportunity for me? They said engineering. And I had the credentials to be an engineer, great in math, great in theory, knew exactly, had an excitement around electrical engineering. And NASA had a scholarship for me. And so I graduated on that June 14th, and I was in school June 26th to start the engineering program.
You were already on that kind of schedule. Were you doing music at the same time?
Yeah, I actually owned my own record company. I was in a group called New Marks. And, you know, after the whole Milli Vanilli thing, we were still doing music, but it was more so a hobby thing at that particular time, because I started interning at Def Jam also. So these are all the things that came into fruition that helped make me prepared for the opportunities that will come to me later in life.
It's funny because I'm looking at this and I sort of looked at it as a linear path. It was just like, well, wait, he was an artist and then he went to intern at Def Jam, but all this stuff was happening at the same time, right?
Yeah, all of it was happening at the same time. I remember I was interning at Def Jam. I was in school. I was on tour with Rob Bass and LeVert and opening up for LL Cool J and Salt and Pepper and Run DMC and Will Smith, the Fresh Prince, and all these things. And I remember getting a call, and I was working as a manager at World Connections Travel, which was a travel agency for condominiums. And I was assistant manager at like 19 or something like this. I forgot how old I was. And it taught me so many things. And I got a call, and that internship turned into a job opportunity. And it was all in preparation. And a lot of people don't look at their life like the next moment is in preparation for the next moment. So I go from, I have an artist first mentality, Jim, because I was an artist first. I have a engineer mentality because I've engineered my way through life. Being a kid coming out of Baltimore, being able to engineer, end up at Def Jam. I had the opportunity to go from intern to president because the people who were my bosses at that time, Leo and Russell, were not afraid of somebody coming in because they were listening and learning.
Were you in high school or something when Milli Vanilli covered your song?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think I was a senior.
Okay.
Or junior. I did my version when I was probably a junior or a sophomore. 86. Yeah, I probably wrote it then, and it came out in 86, which was, I was a senior. And then they remade it in 88.
And now, did that just happen, or did the publisher pitch the song or something? Do you know how it happened?
I didn't know what publishing was back then. I didn't know what royalties were back then. All I knew is I was a big deal in the Mid-Atlantic as an artist, and somebody wanted me to make an album. And I said, I'll do the album for $10,000. And oh shit, I wrote a record that sold 100,000 copies for me, but sold 18 million copies for Milli Vanilli. So it was at that point in time, I said, nah, I don't want to be in the music business. I want to be in the business of music. And so I went to figure it out. You know?
Was that a big, did that make you a lot of money in a short period of time? And then I assume it fell right off after their Grammy debacle, right?
To this day, 30 years later, I still get checks in the mail.
Wow.
So you know, I when you sell 18 million copies and with a song and you're celebrating, one thing you can't take away from it, it was a great song. There were many things that happened around it. Very, very tragic story. But also a triumphant story, because I don't think if that happened to me, I would be sitting here talking to you today, because it really changed my mindset in what we learned the business of music.
How quickly it can all change.
how one day you could think one thing, and the next thing, somebody's on MTV performing your song.
Mm-hmm. So you must have been the wealthiest intern at Def Jam.
I'm not going to say I was the wealthiest intern at Def Jam, but money wasn't a problem back then.
Okay. Money ain't a thing, as someone once said.
We'll be right back with Strictly Business.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good, because every year dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them, but with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
And we're back with Strictly Business.
Let's talk about your years managing, because a lot of the artists you manage are not what you would call easy artists necessarily. Mariah Carey, D'Angelo, you know, not exactly a day at the beach managing those people. What did you learn from managing them? And what was it like managing Mariah Carey? How many years was it?
No, I think that was around 3 years. I don't know how long it really was, but it was with D'Angelo and Mariah, they were friends calling a friend. They were friends that knew I'd gotten to the business, and they were at certain points and they wanted a different insight. They wanted not someone to get a commission, but someone who cared. They wanted someone who understood where they were in their life, and someone that was experienced enough to navigate the things that were going on. And so, and by the way, I know the title was manager, but I really never felt like I managed them. I felt like I advised them. I felt like they were a greatness, and they still are a greatness in some of the national treasures that we will hope to preserve as we continue to grow. But it was very remarkable because one day you're talking about touring, the next day you're talking about scoring movies, the next day you're talking about the Christmas song, all Christmas songs, and the next thing you're talking about doing a residency, and then, oh, you're talking about, well, you know, I think that we're, after 15 years, we're ready to put out a new album. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix and match of everything. And again, still at that point in time, they might have thought that I was helping them, but they were really helping me understand from an iconic level what was the value proposition a CEO needed to bring it to them. And then my younger artists, whether it was Trey or Big Sean or Nelly or any of those guys that came up, Jeezy, they go down the list of artists. It was just the opportunity to be big brother, to be in their life, like maybe their parent, their dad wasn't in their life. And so it really was a great opportunity for me. And that's why I've always adopted that it was family business. So. And you have to think, I still manage today. The things that I did as a manager, the things I did as an artist, are the things that I do as a CEO. This is why I think people are attracted to our company, because I didn't raise people to be record company people. I raised them to be human beings that offered a value proposition every day they showed up to work.
Well, I want to ask you more about managing 300 in just a minute, but I do have to ask you, how did you get D'Angelo to give up that album? Okay, 2 or 3 years earlier, Questlove had said it's 99.9% done. And 2 or 3 more years went by while he continued to finesse it. How did you convince him that it was done and he should let it out? It was a miracle.
Well, listen, it's still a miracle today because we still don't know how it happened. but we know what happened was, if it was up to him, the album would never be ready, because he's his mindset and the way he looks at it. This is his, at that point in his life, it was a culmination of things, and it was his story. He doesn't make music for everybody. He makes it for where he is in his life, and so there were a lot of things that he was going through. And every time he thought he was done, something else would happen that inspired something else. Happen or sound, he would actually tear a whole song down because he heard a new sound or something else, that a new vocal arrangement that came to him overnight, you know, through prayer. And if you think about what was happening around the world, and he called it the Black Messiah, and how it was really before his time, because these prophets that have come up. And the things that have happened in for social justice, these are things D'Angelo was talking about when we dropped the Black Messiah.
Yep.
So it was the precursor to what was happening. So I think it was just a perfect storm and a perfect opportunity for us to see what the world was going to be through the lens of D'Angelo.
We spoke pretty early on in the pandemic, and you had done a lot of things to look out for your staff. You know, there was the free mental health care and a lot of other things. Can you talk about that and the kind of philosophy behind it? Because, you know, you said all that about artists. It almost sounds like you could be talking about your company as well.
I believe we all art in our own way. We all are one-on-ones. We all have different fingerprints. We all are special. And one of the biggest problems that I had with the industry when I left was that we started to treat everything the same, you know, and it became a more commodity business. And, oh, you can put this kind of artist out or get another one like this and put this up. And I never wanted people to be numbers. I never wanted artists to be numbers. I never wanted to operate out of a commission. And I wanted to humanize the business. I got back into the recorded music side to humanize the business. I thought about the father or the mother or the son or the daughter. And I took it personal with the decisions that I made to be the first office to close in New York because of the pandemic. My staff thought I was crazy to do it. And I've taken the steps to be probably one of the last people to go back in because on my watch, I didn't want to have to go to somebody's house or somebody's funeral or tell somebody's parent that because I had them get on the subway to come to work, blah, 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 got infected. I didn't want to do that. So I chose to treat them like I want to treat myself. I have two young daughters that live with me and they have to be in school. So I thought about myself as a father and what it meant to my family. And I can't take back the thought of that, you know, what mental health of issues people were having. And we haven't seen the worst of it yet because post-pandemic, we don't know what it is. It's too early.
Talk quick about the Mary J. Blige deal. How did it come together? Did you work with her at Def Jam? She was at Universal, but I'm not sure where she was at the time.
No, she was at Universal, but I go back to Mary from when she was on Uptown. I'm three decades in the business. I go back to Mary, and we did a very special record back in the day called You're All I Need with her and Method Man. Method Man was signed to Def Jam, and Mary was signed to a Bad Boy of the Uptown, whatever it was at that particular time. But Mary and I are friends. Mary and I, this is not her signing to a label. Mary has her own label. This is me empowering a young woman to have the opportunity to finally express her thoughts and her way, not to do what other people wanted to do, but to do her things. So my label with her and opportunity with her is more so, I would say if you had the opportunity to, and Clive did his best, whether it was Barry Manilow or Aretha Franklin, if you know, you might not assign them, but to have the opportunity to work with a one of none. Mary's a one of none. There'd never be another Mary in the whole land. So to have friends to be able to come together to yell at each other and say, hey, let's put something out. And then God reminds her of what she really meant to do. She's telling you, I've been through the hell that you've been through. Wake up every day and tell yourself, good morning, gorgeous. And look in the mirror and say, good morning, gorgeous. What is that saying? It's going to be something that changes people's lives. Those of us who've been shut down and shut in and shut out and told that we're too fat or too ugly, you know, good morning, gorgeous. So that's my next campaign. You know, that's the next viral thing that I want to push, that we all should be looking in the mirror and saying good morning, gorgeous. And fathers should be saying good morning, gorgeous to their daughters. How about this? Wake up and tell your wife, good morning, gorgeous. So this is a moment in time. And then they say, oh, shit, you know, we're going to perform halftime at the Super Bowl. I can't make this shit up, Jim. You know, right place, right time. But working with friends and who am I to not provide opportunities for some of the greatest icons in the world. And I got more announcements to come.
You've been listening to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment. Thanks for listening.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
It's the Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
Ooh. That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yimby's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that!
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to the Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat, Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.